Danielle Allen's new book, Cuz, is about the American story of mass incarceration. It's also the deeply personal story of her own family. Her cousin Michael. In the 1990s, he went from being a regular 15-year-old to facing a potential life sentence in just one day. Now, Danielle and Michael's families were close, but she became a Harvard professor, and he was arrested for carjacking, serving more than a dozen years, and he died violently in 2009 at the age of 29. So how did that divergence happen? 'Cause, Danielle Allen writes, the war on drugs, mandatory minimum sentences, and a criminal justice system that locked up an entire generation and threw away the key. Well, I recently spoke with Danielle Allen, and we talked about how different her teenage years were from Michael's. She went to prom, had her first kiss, and Danielle said that in prison, Michael faced a very different set of milestones.
First long-term family separation. Yeah. So when he was 17, he was moved from the juvenile into the adult system, and he was moved to a prison at the Oregon border, which is crazy. I mean, it was so far away, his mother couldn't visit him. And, you know, other rituals are, you know, first administrative segregation, as it's called, which is a label for solitary confinement, first racial melee, first sodomization. When I was writing the book, one of the things that was very important to do was to try to juxtapose different teenage experiences, and in particular mine and my cousins, and to show the things that are similar about them, the loneliness, the insecurity, the first experiments with intimacy and relationships and things like that, to show how, you know, this is a teenager going through all those experiences of an ordinary teenager, but in this cauldron of prison that is so violent and so full of brutality.
In the book, we hear Michael's voice.
Yeah.
Because you include a lot of the writing that he did in prison.
He's very talented.
Extraordinarily talented.
Yeah. You know, he was astute. He was smart. He could express the most complex emotions and give voice to experiences that are unimaginable for those of us who've never been inside a prison. So let me just go ahead and read a little bit from his essay about Dante's Inferno. My hell is no longer demonstrating what I am capable of doing in order to survive. It has become what I can tolerate and withstand in order to live. I cannot help but to judge those around me. I am one of them, but we are far from the same. Like Dante, I am cursed with a spirit of discernment, which allows us to see the truth for what it is. There are most whom I despise who are truly sick beyond healing, and they should never leave this place. Then there are those who await to fulfill their destiny. I see in them a sincere and apologetic heart for their ill misdeeds. They are the ones who will change the world positively, or positively change someone's world. Hell cannot hold the latter of the two opposites, but in time will only spit them back out into society to do what is right. The hell that I live in cannot hold Dante. Hell can test and try oneself, but it cannot hold Dante, and it will not hold me. In the inferno, the dead are trapped forever. Surely the biggest and most important difference in the inferno and my hell called prison is that I have a way out.
So right after that chapter where it's Michael's essay, there are two, I think, quite amazing chapters. And they're all about you, really. And these two chapters are two different takes on how you felt or what you saw when you visited Michael in prison.
Right, yes.
So tell
us
about the first chapter.
Sure. So maybe I'll just read you a paragraph of it to give you sort of a flavor, some of the flavor of it.
And this chapter is called Visiting 1.0.
Visiting 1.0, exactly. Yeah. As Michael, known to the system as K10033, wrote, inmates went by numbers, not names. And visiting days were allocated to sets of numbers. Half of the evens on one Saturday, half of the odds on Sunday. The other halves of each set the following week. At 7:30 a.m., the guards would let a parade of Kias and Hyundais, Chevys and Dodges into the parking lot, and then you would sign in at a lectern at the front of a canopied structure with wooden benches that looked something like a tent revival meeting. Hosts of mainly black and brown women, but white women too, and many children, and some men, flitted in the shadows under the canopy. We could take in up to $30 in quarters or singles in plastic baggies, and we always took the maximum. The point of this was to purchase treats for the inmates from the row of vending machines, dispensing, as it turned out, quite disgusting microwavable cheeseburgers and burritos, along with mystery meat plates. So that's, I had sort of written a chapter about visiting that tried to go into the just the detail of the place, the people who were there, the things you saw, the things you smelled, and so forth. But if you listen to that, I always am talking about, you see this, you see that, you do that. And my editor kept coming back and saying, you're not in this chapter, Danielle. You're not in this chapter. And I didn't know what he meant. I was like, but I'm describing everything I saw, you know, this detail, that detail, and so forth. And finally, I realized what he meant, which is that up in the book, in that up until that point, I had been using I. Uh-huh. I had been saying, I felt, I did X. And suddenly in this chapter, I switched to you. And that was like this huge light bulb going off that even at this point, you know, many drafts into working on the book, I had not been able to break through a certain kind of repression to say, I was in prison and here's what it was like for me. So I went back and wrote that chapter.
And so you wrote it. You wrote it again.
I wrote it again. So then we have Visiting 2.0. So I can read a little bit of that. I will have to try again to describe what visiting Michael meant to me. The fact that I told the story as an academic already tells you everything you need to know. That wound of visiting Michael in prison goes so deep that somehow, even in writing this book, I have found it hard to own up to one simple fact. I went to prison. I was in prison. No, I don't mean that I have been arrested or convicted of a crime. I have avoided that because thus far in life, I have had that combination of goods that the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle thought was necessary for a happy life. Resources, decent character, and luck. But no, I was not in prison as a convict, and this is thanks to my father, my mother, and my God. Yet even as someone who could come and go, I felt the prison's mark, its branding fork. I felt it in my soul, even though all I was there was a day's sojourner.
You okay?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Forgive me for saying this, but that duality that we see in the first and second chapter there, I've even seen it here just
right
in our conversation.
I'm not surprised.
I mean, I can see that there are times when we're talking about sort of the policy implications of
right.
of criminal justice that you have a bold confidence. But when we get close to talking about really the impact that this has had on you and,
right.
and Michael, it's hard.
Yeah, no, it's hard. I mean, you know, the whole point of being an academic is that you don't do this kind of thing. But so I'm grateful to Michael because one of the things I've learned from doing this is just how important it is. Sorry. Even as an academic, to put head and heart together.
You and your family put so much effort into trying to rebuild his life. But his story is one where he could not get past the wounds and the consequences
right.
of those wounds that he suffered while in prison. And he got killed.
Yeah, no, that's right. Well, it's just, you know, at the time when he was thinking about whether to take this apartment, I could not understand his thinking, his choice. I could not see I had no idea what was going on. I could make no sense of it at all. All I knew is, you know, at the end of 24 hours, he decided firmly that he wasn't going to take the apartment. And then it wasn't until four or five months later when he called and said he was ready to take an apartment. And I went to go look at it with him. And he said that he and his girlfriend, Bree, were going to move into the apartment. Bree was his girlfriend whom he'd met in prison. Mm-hmm. So a transgender woman. They'd been lovers in prison, and I did not know that they were still seeing each other. They had reconnected after he got out. And I suddenly understood that that was what his decision-making was about that day when he couldn't take that apartment. It was a choice right then between Bree's world and the world he had had for the last 11 years and the world of his family, which he'd had too, but over the telephone. And with that choice in front of him, he chose the love of his life.
What is the lesson from Michael's life?
You know, I've been trying to boil it down to just one lesson, and I just find it impossible to do. I think Michael himself took responsibility for his choices, and his Dante essay makes that very clear. He understood he'd made the wrong choices, and he understood himself to have been motivated by, in his words, greed and lust in the moment when he tried to steal the car. And he knew that, and he changed, and he had a view about what was wrong with his own decision-making. But at the same time that he accepted personal responsibility for his own choices, I think as a society, we also have to accept responsibility for the fact that we present young people with vastly disparate degrees of difficulty on the life courses in front of them. And yes, even in the most difficult circumstances, some people can master the degree of difficulty and overcome, but many people can't. And when society is leaving young people in poverty, leaving young people without access to good education, we have to recognize that we are creating the patterns, the degrees of difficulty that they're obliged to confront.
Danielle Allen is author of 'Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A.'